Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks very much for joining us today. I just spoke with Daryl Flaherty about his new book, Public Law, Private Practice: Politics, Profit, and the Legal Profession in 19th Century Japan. That came out with the Harvard University Asia Center of Harvard University Press in 2013. This is a book for you whether you're interested in the history of the public sphere, the history of modern Japan, the history of the legal profession, or the history of global modernity. It's a book that revises what we tend to think of and the stories that we tend to tell about the place of some of the modern institutions of Japan within a larger global framework. And that is, stories tend to place the emergence of, for example, a modern legal profession in Japan within a larger frame of influence by and domination by more modern, more rational legal frameworks and legal ideas and legal theories coming in from what we might call the West. Now, what the book does instead is it looks at a deep history of Edo period practices of private law practice. That is, private law practices that are happening in kinds of spaces that we don't typically think of when we think of the history of legal firms, legal spots of education, law schools, and it puts together stories of those kinds of vernacular legal understandings, local legal practices in places like tea houses, in places like suit inns, as you'll hear about in a few minutes, and it weaves those together into a very different kind of story of the emergence of what ultimately we come to know as a lawyer in late 19th century Japan. It's really interesting. It's based on a very detailed reading of lots of different kinds of historical sources, and it is very accessible and very illuminating whether or not you know anything about or are inherently interested in the histories of modern Japan. So it was a pleasure to talk with Daryl about it. I learned a lot from reading the book, and I hope you enjoy both the book and the conversation. We're here today to talk with Daryl Flaherty about his new book, Public Law, Private Practice: Politics, Profit, and the Legal Profession in 19th Century Japan. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Daryl, and thanks very much for making the time to talk with me today about your brand new book.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners about my book and my work.
So, Daryl, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background and specifically what brought you to the field of the study of modern Japan?
I'll start with my first encounter with Japan, which was in the early 1980s. I went to Kyoto as an exchange student, and while I was there, I had this sort of episode. I came from St. Louis, which at the time during the early 1980s was a city gripped by a lot of violent crime, and I pulled out a map and asked my host family to show me where it was safe to ride a bicycle in Kyoto. And they really didn't understand this. In St. Louis, you could redline neighborhoods and say, oh, you shouldn't ride there. People might throw rocks at you, or they might try to run you off the road. But in Kyoto, that was sort of incomprehensible to them. And I'm telling that story because it really got me thinking in that moment when they were sort of befuddled and confused about what might be a high crime area or where I should not go. I really started to think about what freedom meant in the context of Japan and the context of the United States. Now, I was pretty young then. I was just in high school, so I didn't have a very sophisticated grasp at the time. But over a couple of years of going back and forth to Japan, this really became a key concern of mine. And that's, in some ways, a lot of my thinking and writing and researching about Japanese history has come out of that first and early encounter.
Wow, that's really interesting. That actually speaks really interestingly to the topic of the book as well. So speaking of which, the book that we're talking about today explores many things, but they can be kind of broadly subsumed for the purpose of a brief description under the topic of private legal practice in the 19th century. So private legal practice in 19th century Japan, what did that mean? Where was that instantiated? And how does that link up to some broader ways that we understand the emergence of modernity, of the nation state and the role of the individual in publics within that larger frame? So we'll talk about many of these components over the course of our conversation. But before that, it would be great if you could say a little bit about what brought you from the general field of modern Japanese studies and perhaps a special interest in freedom within that to the specific focus that we're looking at in terms of the book today?
As a graduate student at Columbia University, I was doing research for my master's thesis on suffrage. And so much of the literature on the suffrage movement in Japan focuses on labor, the labor movement, labor activism against the state. And the more I was reading about state and society relations in Japan, the more I saw this kind of dichotomous tension, this oppressive, overweening state, and an almost supine society that it sometimes would rise up in anger and sort of lash out. But as I began to examine the actual process of the passage of the Universal Manhood Suffrage Law in 1925, I saw that there were all these other actors sort of in the middle between those two poles. And that labor sort of really got out of the suffrage business by the beginning of the 1920s. And these other actors really carried the ball forward. And they included lawyers and doctors and local political elites and these kinds of people. And so I began to think that I wanted to study those groups, the sort of political middle in Japanese history. I began to do that. And I really began to realize that that was much too broad a question to look at in terms of looking at lawyers, doctors, and local political elites. And so I ultimately focused on lawyers because I saw them involved in so many different activities. So that was how I began to focus on this topic.
Great. One of the interesting things that I'll probably, that we'll come back to, I think, later on is, or you know what, I'm just going to lay this out for you
at
the beginning. Because part of the argument of the book, as we'll see, is that the category lawyer emerged sort of late in the story, right? It wasn't necessarily the case that there were concrete individuals calling themselves or that we would call lawyers in the same kind of professional sense throughout the story. How did you identify who counted as part of this prehistory of or history of lawyers before the category emerged late in the story for the purpose of your research?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I mean, as you noticed when I was talking about the project, I started in the 1920s. But we sort of move, you know, as you'll notice also, the book doesn't really get up to that part of the story. And so what happened, as so often happens when you start with a project, you realize, wow, there isn't really a satisfactory sort of prehistory to the history that I'm proposing to write. And you do so much work on the prehistory that in the end, you're really sort of doing a different project from the one that you initially set out to do on. So initially, I imagined that I was going to write an early 20th century history with a brief sort of 19th century preamble. And what I ended up doing was doing a lot more research in the late 19th century than I ever anticipated. And then going back even further and doing work on the Edo period, which wasn't originally part of the project at all. So that's sort of how I've sort of pushed the project back chronologically. And then in terms of category, you're absolutely right. What I came to realize was that this idea of lawyer doesn't really firm up on the world scene globally until the end of the 19th century. If we're thinking, well, it depends on what you're talking about, but we can say, you know, early to mid to late 19th century, depending on where. But this idea of lawyer doesn't really emerge. It's really professionalized and institutionalized by the end of the 19th century globally. And so that's part of the project, is to say, if we want to think about Japanese history comparatively, then it's important not to think about legal practice during the 19th century as the work of lawyers, but rather as what I call them, private legal practitioners.
So you've already started to get at this just in your answer to the previous question, but more broadly, in transitioning this from a project that you worked on as a dissertation to a project that we are seeing now in the form of a final book, were there any major transformations or any other major transformations along the way that shifted either practically how you were working on the project or conceptually how you thought of your research and the kind of stuff that you were arguing in the final project?
I mean, the big shift was that originally I thought about this as a study of an association. I mean, as I narrowed things down and focused on legal practitioners, I really began to focus on lawyers and particularly their national group, which was the Nihon Bengoshi Kyokai, then Japanese Lawyers Association, which was a national voluntary association. And so when I originally conceptualized the dissertation, that's what I was looking at. But as I began to look more and more at the late 19th and then also at the Edo period, sort of prehistory, I found that to be in many ways more interesting. And also, as you work on a project, you get input from many others. And people were beginning to say to me, this doesn't really look like the history of an association in particular, but it looks like the history of these individual practitioners, or it looks like the engagement of these practitioners with systems or with other individuals. So I began to explore lots of different avenues and sort of widen the scope and push it back chronologically into the Edo period.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
So now that we've got the kind of prehistory of the project, let's get right into it.
Okay.
Now, what I'll do is I'll spend a little bit of time just kind of laying the framework, and then I'll ask you to kind of jump in,
okay,
in a minute or so.
Sure.
So one of the things that's laid out right at the very beginning is the fact that the book does something important in terms of questioning the dominant paradigms within which we understand the history of modern Japan and the history of legality and law in modern Japan specifically. So you say right at the beginning that you're going to question through this book the dominance of what you call the modernization paradigm in explaining the legal and political history of Japan. Now, the way this paradigm typically goes for listeners who are perhaps unfamiliar with this mode of Japanese history, it tends to take for granted that individuals in the West enjoyed what you call expanding political participation and increased protection from the power of the state, while people in Japan didn't. So the East falls short relative to the West, with Japan being sort of linked up with the East here, due in no small part to the absence of a distinction between public law and private law. Thus, public complaints and disputes required, or private complaints and disputes, rather, as you put it early in the book, require public attention. So in contrast to that narrative, the book really persuasively argues that Europe and the U.S., the West, as we might consider it, did not make legal modernity and then export it in Japan. In contrast, in early 19th century Edo society, which is where the book focuses, there was already a really interesting, really vibrant, really hybrid and plural legal culture, producing engaged private practitioners of various sorts in various kinds of spaces, and which laid the foundation for what you call an epistemology of law in the late 19th century. Okay, so that's the kind of framework from which we're proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that's happening in the book, and this is something that the argument repeatedly comes back to, so I just kind of want to set it out at the beginning for listeners. Private practitioners in the course of this story are repeatedly grappling with treaties that happen early on in this story that limit Japanese sovereignty. So a lot of the book hinges on reactions to, understandings of, and attempts to push back against the series of what you call unequal treaties that are happening as kind of the prehistory of what we see later on in the story. The Meiji government is trying to overturn these unequal treaties. The individual practitioners are also trying to grapple with this. So, so that listeners have a sense of what exactly is being grappled with, can
Sure.
you kind of start us off by explaining what do we need to know about what's happening with these unequal treaties early in the story in order to understand the kinds of reactions to them that are shaping the legal history and the history of legal practitioners that come later?
Okay. Before we get to the treaties, I mean, I'd like to go back to Edo, if we could.
Oh, yeah.
Because in a sense, I mean, I think when you talk about overturning a paradigm, I mean, that's really where the work is beginning for me in this book. And so what I'm looking at there is the emergence of private legal practice within Japan itself before this encounter with Europe and the United States. And so the treaties are the sort of the mechanisms by which Europeans and Americans make their power felt on the ground in Meiji Japan and also earlier, of course. But during the Edo period, we see, and what I'm arguing is that there was a private legal practice that existed before this encounter. And the people, and if we compare it to the private legal practice that existed in Europe and the United States at the same time, then we see more similarities perhaps than differences. So that's sort of why I begin with the Edo period. And then when we get to the treaties, we have this sense that for the Japanese state, that Japan is being measured against a standard of civilization from the outside, Japan does not meet, Japanese society does not meet. And so from the inside, you see reformers, state reformers, trying to transform Japanese society from within by transforming law. There's nothing new to that story. There's lots of people been writing and researching that element of the story. But what I bring to the table, which is new, is a discussion of how that was really working out from the bottom up. And what I argue is that if there hadn't been both this pre-existing private legal practice during the Edo period and then a bottom-up engagement with that whole reform project, then it would not have produced the fruits that it ultimately did. Whether they were bitter fruits or sweet fruits, I'll leave that up to others. The fruits that it produced would not have been possible without some sort of bottom-up private legal practice, both during the Edo period and then during the Meiji period.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
So, Chapter 1 calls the state-centered narrative of Japanese legal history into question. And it does that by exploring the fact that despite the fact that the Tokugawa state is actually prohibiting the dissemination of legal texts, it's a really interesting part of the story, legal knowledge in Tokugawa Japan was actually really widespread. And by the end of the 18th century, there were two main forms of Edo-era legal practice. So I'm going to ask you to introduce both of those because they are very important parts of this story. One of those forms was what you called state-sanctioned suit-ins in towns and cities. So can you introduce those? What were they and what role do they play at this part of the story?
Sure. There were state-sanctioned suit-ins were the inns that emerged in Edo, but also in all the major castle towns and also in the cities and towns that were directly controlled by the Tokugawa. For example, in Nikko, there was a suit-in. And so what these inns did was that if someone was coming to one of these sites on official business, they could lodge at these inns, and in some cases they were required to lodge at specific inns. And then they would go to whatever office of the state apparatus that they had official business with, and then they would conduct their business and then go about their activities. So these suit inns were over the course of the Edo period became initially they were a kind of begrudgingly allowed to provide the kinds of services that they did to petitioners. But then over time, they became increasingly powerful, forming guilds and becoming closer and closer to the state offices that they served.
So what would you be able to do at one of these suit inns that you couldn't do otherwise if you were somebody involved in a legal complaint?
Well, they provided all kinds of services. The idea was that from the state perspective, the idea was that they would simply produce documents that were necessary to the state so that they would draft a petition, that they would notify the state that the person had arrived, so they had a kind of supervisory role that they would perhaps supervise these people when they were in town, make sure that they didn't stray too far away, that they would be available if they were called to state offices. But as a petitioner, you would come to the suit-in and you would really be seeking legal advice. You would want help to try to resolve your conflict, whether it was a conflict with the state, what I call inquisitorial matters, in our current legal system would be called a criminal matter. Or if you had what we would call a civil matter, and what at the time was a sort of adversarial matter between two private parties. You would come to one of these inns and you would seek advice on how to resolve your conflict. So the role of these suit-ins went well beyond simply drafting documents. It went, I would argue that we can see that there was evidence of advice from the suit-ins to the petitioners.
Now, you talk about a transformation of these suit-ins with the formation of guilds, and this actually seems really significant to this story, in part because in this period before the emergence of these guilds, there were other places that you could go to aside from the suit-ins if you wanted help with this sort of stuff, right? Tea houses, you mentioned, but also other kinds of spaces. And so what changes significantly with the consolidation of these guilds?
Well, what the guilds did was that they gave the student proprietors a monopoly on the business of lodging people coming to the to Edo or to cities or castle towns to bring a case. And in particular, in inquisitorial matters, if the state summons someone, this is what I mentioned just a little bit ago, if the state summons someone, this, you know, they could be required to lodge at one of these inns. So that was very beneficial for the inn. It could require a person, you know, would go and issue the summons and then bring that person forward to the state. And then it would, in a sense, hold them almost like a pretrial holding and then bring them before before the state, you know, before the state offices or state officers. So that's one kind of function that the guilds provided, allowed for these students to monopolize that business. There were all sorts of businesses I mentioned that emerged outside of the offices of the, for example, the Machibugyojo, the town commissioner in Edo. People would come to hear, have a case heard, and they might petition to have the case heard, and they would be told to come back or they would be told to wait a few hours. And so tea houses or noodle shops emerged here, and these people would eventually try to provide legal services as well, or scrivening services as well. But really the students tried to, and in, I can't say that they were fully successful, but they were able to edge out or suppress competition from these other sources of potential legal advice.
So including the students, which are state-sanctioned, one of these other sources of potential legal advice came in the form of suit solicitors. So they are not state-sanctioned. Can you say a little bit about them and what role are they providing for somebody who needs legal advice and legal help in this period?
Sure. I think it's probably important here to mention some mention a little bit more broadly what the attitude of the state was towards litigation, and particularly towards private litigation during the Edo period. And the state took pretty strongly to the Confucian idea that there should not be any litigation. Confucius had the Analects makes a statement that, you know, make it so that there is no litigation. And so the Tokugawa state really took this to heart and so tried to suppress private disputes. It viewed them as a kind of challenge to the idea or the notion that the state was providing or creating harmony in Japan. And so there was this idea that there should not be private disputes. And the private disputes were, in a sense, an example of the failure of the state. But, of course, people did have disputes. They would have disputes about someone not paying a loan or someone not providing, you know, someone not – there would be all kinds of, you know, different kinds of disputes that emerged during the Edo period, particularly as commerce became increasingly complex. And so you had people going to Edo, of course, if they had a dispute that required or that might merit – shogunal intervention, but there were all kinds of other suits at all other kinds of levels of society. And so we have evidence in the historical record of these people, kujishi or suit solicitors, who were operating, but it's tough to sort of track them down because they were prohibited usually by village compact, but also by the domains and also by the shogunate itself. And so it's difficult to track the activities of the suit solicitors who were whose activities were prohibited. But I use a lot of, I look at a number of different sources and stories to try to sketch out what their activities would have been.
From the perspective of craft, what were some of the important kinds of sources that you used to get access to this group of people who otherwise may have been written out of a lot of histories of legal practice in Japan?
For the Edo period, I'm really looking to a lot of secondary sources. But sources that, and sort of standard sources like Umze's Tokugawa Law and Practice, in particular his discussion of the story of Ken, this villager who, this woman villager who's, you know, fighting against both her village elders and her family. And I think that we can see evidence in that story. We can see evidence in a number of stories of the sort of classic stories of village uprisings, where the villagers could not have achieved or advanced within state systems of power without the advice or support of someone who was both both literate, but also that had knowledge of how the state structured its power in a legal way. In other words, how it, you know, what the laws were, what the rules were for petitioning, what the kind of claims one could make, for redress and that kind of thing. So those were some of the challenges I had. So I tried to read these Edo sources from the perspective, from the idea that there were these Kujishi, because clearly they existed. They were prohibited. I mean, they were almost continually and repeatedly prohibited from the earliest part of the Edo period. From 1640 is one of the first examples of a statement in the Shōho Jiroku, and it's one of the statements from Edo where it says, you know, we shouldn't allow private practice. We shouldn't allow this kind of litigiousness in our society. So,
great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
So as we move from chapter one, which also includes some really interesting stories about histories of legal knowledge in terms of vernacular storytelling, and also looks at aspects of the historiography of these phenomena and considers why the kinds of issues that you're bringing up, I think, so compellingly in this chapter have often been written out of the histories of law and legality in modern Japan, we then turn to a chapter on what you call processes and practitioners. Chapter 2 looks at the lived experiences of a kind of bringing together of morality and law during the 1870s, primarily through the careers of two legal advocates. So what we see here, before we get to these two legal advocates, there are some transformations in the kind of landscape of legality in Japan and the kinds of sources that come in as being relevant and important to take on by these two individuals who are sort of representative of two communities that you look at. And so before we get to them, let's talk about some of those transitions. After the 1870s, as you describe here, law began to shift from what you call a tool for ruling to what you call a totalizing epistemological framework that called forth a nation state. Now, this shift is marked by a kind of synthesis or hybridization, both of earlier legal practices, so the kinds of practices that we talked about and saw in Chapter 1, with legal theories coming in from Europe and the U.S., so one of the most important of these legal theories coming in, or these legal, what we might call them, tools or technologies coming in from Europe and the U.S. is the French legal code. Mm-hmm. Okay, so to set the stage here on which we're going to place our two examples from this chapter, can you talk a little bit about why the French legal code emerges as being so important in this context within this ecology of other kinds of legal theories coming into Japan from Europe and the U.S.?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you sort of lighted on the French civil code, it's often called the Napoleonic Code. This was, this is part of a key sort of mechanism for thinking about Japanese history in a broader comparative context. So oftentimes one hears about how during the Meiji period we have this kind of shopping around. And it is true that that's how it worked. But in a sense, the Napoleonic Code was seized upon because it was seen not just in Japan, but worldwide as a kind of a collection of best practices. And so Meiji legal reformers turned to the Napoleonic Code as a kind of package of legal practices that would, and almost like a ticket that would gain them entry to the civilized world, this world that was measuring them and finding them to, you know, finding that they were coming up short, and therefore that it was appropriate to apply the unequal treaties to Japan from the 1850s going onward. And so the sense for early reformers like Itō Shimpei and others was that by translating this code and applying it, that Japan could sort of escape the trap of the unequal treaties if it could just reform its laws and if it could just simply adopt this code. So that was the appeal of the Napoleonic Code. But it was a code that was widely, there were people in the United States who argued for its adoption during the 19th century. Of course, it was adopted in France. It was influential in Germany. It was influential in a number of European colonies throughout the world during the 19th century.
Great, thank you. So as we try to understand these two examples of larger categories of people who are then hybridizing and responding to this new kind of hybrid environment of legal discourse, legal practice, we need to understand that as of 1872, these two sort of major categories we had been talking about, the suit-ins and the suit solicitors, are actually replaced with three new occupational categories. And these are developed according to French models, right? So following through the importance of the French legal code as our major point here. These right. three categories are the legal advocate, the legal mm-hmm. scrivener, and the notary. Now, right. two of these legal advocates emerge as being really important to your story. And so let's look at them in turn and talk about their relevance given the broader arguments you're making here. The first one is Sonotel. She's fascinating. She is known as the first woman lawyer in Japan, although that's, you know, a little bit more complicated, as you right. show in the story. Can you right. introduce her and talk about her importance to this part of the story?
Sure. There are these two figures. I'm going to go ahead and introduce them both here because they really are sort of okay. dancing pair for me. So, Sonotel is really... there are a few people within Japan or Japanese legal circles who would say she's the first woman lawyer. She's even the first anything in Japan. I don't even know if she's known to Japanese legal history. I haven't seen her identified within the discussion of early legal practitioners. She comes to my attention because of her autobiography that she wrote in the tradition of a kind of conversion narratives, Christian conversion narratives of the 19th century. She joined the International Temperance Union, and she was a proponent of temperance from the United States, who then went back to Japan in the late 19th century, 1890s. But in the 1870s through the early 1880s, she says that she practiced, she was engaged in private legal practice as a daigenin or legal advocate in Tokyo. And it's interesting. She's very interesting to me because of her idea of what legal practice should and would be. It's really an extension or continuity of what law was coming out of the Edo period. But at the same time, she's this radical figure because she's a woman who was engaged in private legal practice. And it appears that there were she was joined in this by others, although I do focus on her. And then I see it as a kind of counterpart, this guy Kodama Junichiro, who was a former samurai out of Yamaguchi, and who was sent to Japan first by his domain and then by the Meiji state to learn about legal practice in the United States. And so he was a pretty this cosmopolitan guy. But what's interesting to me about both of these is that the Christianity figured so largely for them. And so while in retrospect, many people, when they talk about modernization or modernity or Japan, there is this focus on a kind of rational legal narrative that where we see the moral or idea of morality falling away. And in particular, the modernization narrative doesn't really talk about morality very much at all. But we see in the lives of both of these figures the centrality of Christianity. Sono comes to Christianity later in the story. She's really, I suggested she kind of has a Confucian Christian piety. And for Kodama, he converts, he becomes actually a minister while he's in the United States. But that sort of disappears once he returns back to Japan and he's seeking a high bureaucratic appointment. But there are both these kinds of figures operating in tandem for whom morality really matters in ways that figure much more largely than one usually hears about in the suggestion of the quest for a rational legal modernity that's supposedly embodied in the West. So those are why they were exciting and fun for me to look at. So
great. Now, as we move forward, one of the things that we're going to see later on is that there's going to be a transformation in the kind of education that you're expected to have and the kind of training that goes into qualifying somebody to be a practicing legal advocate and then ultimately mm-hmm. lawyer in this later period. So just to kind of understand the nature of that transition for when we get there, I wonder if you wouldn't mind just spending a little bit of time just staying with, before we move on from them, Sonotel and Kodama Junichiro, and just saying a little bit about how are they being educated? I know the answer is not the same for the two of them. And right. How is that education translating into the kinds of qualifications that are being recognized by the people they're arguing in front of as legitimating them to having some stake or some status within the field of legal practice that they're both yeah. involved in?
I mean, this is really where we see the kind of echoes to the Edo period, right? So, and we see this as a continuity all the way into the early 20th century. We have a kind of status designation. You can be a daigenin, a legal advocate, but how did you get that? Well, initially, you just simply called yourself a legal advocate, and then you could, and that was all you needed to do, really, as long as you were you were literate and you weren't blind, and you were of age, then you could go before the court and call yourself a legal advocate. That was in the early years. And so in terms of training, Sono Teru, she perhaps did some reading in there were a number of code books that were put out by the Meiji state at the time. There were a number of different translations. This becomes more important, as you're suggesting, as the story goes on. But in this earliest moment, there were people who were holdovers from the Edo period, and they simply called themselves legal advocates and then practiced before the court, reading court digests or cases of opinions. Or there were sort of very short pamphlets or books that were put out that sort of fit inside. I talk a little bit about how they could fit inside your kimono sleeve, because there was the sense that many of these people were perhaps ill-prepared, and they would just sort of tuck these kind of crib boats books into their kimono before they went before the court. But in any event, there wasn't any kind of formal legal education in this early period. And that was the case all throughout, not just in Japan, but also throughout the world in terms of private legal practice. We don't really see the formalization and institutionalization of legal training until the end of the 19th century. And so both Sono and Kodama, so Sono sort of self-trained, and Kodama got his training by going abroad and observing the U.S. court system. But both of them, operating within this very fluid system, which both drew on Edo period precedents, but then also was looking outward, in particular to French models, but other European legal models, American legal models, depending on the judge, to try trials to resolve disputes.
Great, thanks so much. Now, as we move forward into the later chapters and into the next chapter in particular, we're going to start to see this transformation and the kind of education that's going to be codified and available to legal practitioners. And this is going to continue to change throughout the later chapters as well. Now, remind us late in the second chapter that Kodama is actually a former samurai.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the next chapter turns to looking more directly at the larger class that he's part of. So where were former samurai in this larger history? Interestingly, some of them are actually, trying to find jobs, and they turn to legal study. And this next chapter, chapter 3, sort of looks at some of the really wide-ranging consequences of that by giving us a really wonderfully detailed kind of play-by-play narrative of the transformation of the career of one of them into this organization that then goes on to become transformative and also emblematic of larger transformations that we see in the emergence of groups of legal practitioners and the kinds of education available to them. So let's turn to this. One good way to do this is to turn right to an example that you use right at the beginning of this chapter that really emblematizes these transformations. And this is an example of a legal enterprise created by a former samurai, Kitada Matsutadashi, and an elite commoner, Teramura Tomi. And this is this group that emerges called Hogoshusha. So introduce that for us, if you would, and as a way to get at what are the kinds of transformations we're seeing in this part of the story, and how does this organization kind of start and emblematize those?
Yeah. So again, if we think back to the Edo period, I want to stress that samurai were not engaged in private legal practice during the Edo period. So I want to state that emphatically here. And so by the time we get to the early Meiji period, and we sort of get a kind of ratification of legal activity in the changing laws. We have figures like Kodama who practices, emerges as a kind of private practitioner before he enters the bureaucracy. You begin to get samurai who are former samurai by this point, who are saying, maybe we should engage in this kind of private legal practice. Maybe it's okay. Maybe it's even right. Maybe this is what we need to do. And as they begin to read and think about political theory from Europe and the United States and begin to reflect on their own position in society, they think, this is the kind of function that we occupied within the state previously, and particularly for those people who left state service as a result of the debate over invading Korea. They think this could be a mechanism or a means by which we could re-enter positions of power, positions of leadership and authority. And so you find some folks who were involved in oftentimes former bureaucrats, people who worked within the court system, people who were allies of Eto Shinpei or others, they say, well, we're going to leave and start up our own private legal practice. And this, the Hokushusha is an example of that. And so what you see is former samurai engaging in private legal practice as an occupation, as a means for making money. But also what they do is they establish associations that are really hybrid in their pursuit. These associations, like the Hokushusha, trained people to become private legal practitioners. They were profit-making enterprises. The Hokushusha was very successful, so successful that it would give its employees large bonuses and sponsor parties for them at key times of the year, not just Bonenkai, but cherry blossom festivals and all kinds of things, and theater outings, and would give them a sake a stipend. These were wealthy enterprises. And these former samurai began to use these to also fund their political activity to, again, try to transform the political environment in which they operated. And really start political parties, which is part of the story in just a moment.
That's right.
Exactly. But I don't want to get too far ahead of us. So.
Oh, well, first of all, let's get to the public sphere. We'll get to political parties after the public sphere.
Sure.
Okay. So this is a part of the story where anybody who's interested in the history, historiography, general theory of the public sphere will perk up their ears, because that's what this is all about in the second part of this chapter. So this group that you just described is one of many kinds of groups and associations that are forming in this period in a context in which, as you describe it, the relationship between the individual and the government is changing, it's reconceptualizing, and it informs the study of lawlitics by several other kinds of groups, including the one that you just mentioned. So these kinds of groups include debate groups, study groups, and one of the reasons this is so important is that, as you argue here, this helps create new spaces for public practices and public activities. And so could you talk a little bit about that part of the story and how this relates to your argument about the ways that this intersects with and engages with larger notions of a public sphere?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I want to stress that this is a global historical moment, not just a Japanese historical trend, and that these people within Japan were part of a larger political, sort of global legal and political discourse. For example, Rudolf Magnist, he wrote a treatise on the legal state, and this was read by folks within Japan, and so they really focused on the idea of the rule of law and establishing rule of law within Japan. So, and here I'm talking about these former samurai who were establishing these private legal practices. And so when you mention space, oftentimes people think of that as just a kind of empty metaphor, but really we are talking about the physical spaces of the offices of the folks who were engaged in these private legal practices. They built, the Hokushusha had many branches. They had a branch in Tokyo, Osaka, and down in Kobe, I guess, and Hiroshima. So they had a number of branches, and these were pretty substantial buildings. And people would come and meet in these buildings and talk about political issues. They served as a kind of base for people to stop in after. Folks would go to the Meiroksha, and then they'd stop in because there would always be someone working at one of these after and have a drink or something like that. So they were a physical space. And they were also, though, in that kind of metaphorical vein, they were a place in which people conceptualized what it meant to sort of challenge the state. So oftentimes the idea of the public or society is juxtaposed with the state. And for many of these former samurai practitioners of private legal practice in the 1870s and 1880s, they really saw themselves as taking an oppositional tack and attempting to transform Japanese society by creating a separate public sphere independent of state intrusion.
And this is happening at the same time as a transformation in the kinds of and availability of print media that are enabling this. So would you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Some of these figures, like Hoshitoru, he had his own newspaper, right? So it was called the Japanese name is escaping me for the moment, but Lanterns of Liberty is, I mean, he had both the English and the Japanese on the masthead, and he had a big picture of the British House of Parliament and the Thames. And so for a figure who is a private legal practitioner like Hoshitoru, their private legal practice activities could, you know, sort of finance the kind of print culture that would promote their ideas. Also, the activities of the private legal practitioners before the courts was great theater. Again, we're sort of getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves in the chronology. But if we think about the 1883 trial and the Fukushima incident, we can see how this really made exciting news. And the private legal practitioners became kind of heroes in the freedom and popular rights movement. And people would read about them and celebrate their activities in print. So they really figure both as producers of producers of print media and from a kind of oppositional position, but also they figure as subjects of the print media itself.
Great. Now you mentioned Hoshitoru. He's actually the focus of the next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So the next chapter uses as an example to get at the kinds of social and political transformations in legal advocacy in the late 19th century, as well as sort of ways of understanding the application of a legal education to a political career. And here we see the emergence of this concern with political parties that we mentioned before. So you mention Hoshitoru in the context of this chapter as an example of the kind of emergence of a figure of a professional lawyer, but you mm-hmm. also mention him as a way of giving us a glimpse into how legal advocates like him paved the way for the emergence of political parties in Japan. So let's get right to that. Can you talk a little bit about him, sort of introduce him
sure.
a little bit, and what
yeah.
we need to know to understand the way he kind of helps us get at the emergence of political parties in Japan?
Yeah. I mean, Hoshi is an extraordinary figure, and I've been criticized by some people for using him but I'm sort of having it both ways with Hoshi. In some ways, he's an exemplary figure, and he's really fun to talk about because of how exemplary he is and how extraordinary he is. He was a former commoner. He worked in the tax and tariff bureau in Yokohama. He went up against Harry Parks, who was the British ambassador to Japan at the time, over calling Her Majesty the Queen while he called the Japanese emperor an emperor. And that was problematic for Parks because he thought the Queen should be called an emperor as well. And so, ironically, the Meiji government decided that the solution to this was to send Hoshi to London to study in the Inns of Court. So he went to England and became one of the first Japanese barrister. Now we know that this was important to him because in his papers, which are at the National Diet Library, he preserved the wax seal that he received welcoming him to the British Inns to become a member of the Inns of Court. So he was a barrister and he came back to Japan and there was really no sort of equivalent of. He didn't want to become a private practitioner because the social status for private practitioners was low at the time. And he got a government sinecure, but that sort of didn't work out for him. And so he decided that he would become an activist supporter of private, of political parties. And so he hooked up with the Liberal Party. But he's a kind of exemplary figure, but there were so many other figures. And I mentioned the kind of hybrid nature of the associations of legal advocates. And if you look at the Liberal Party throughout Japan and its establishment in the early 1880s, you'll see that almost every party branch was founded by or co-founded by someone who was a private legal practitioner. So this was really the material base, I would argue, for the Liberal Party, not just the material base, but also the kind of ideological base for the formation of the Liberal Party in Japan at this time. So Hoshi is a great sort of figure to look at that. But behind him, there were many, many other figures who are less fun and less flamboyant, but at the same time, deeply embedded in the establishment of the party, the Liberal Party.
There were, speaking of his fun and flamboyance, there were many elements of that description of him that I really loved, including you mentioned he was known for his, quote, passionate masculinity. I love that. I'm using that for some reason in my casual conversation as I move forward this week. And he also has this reputation as a fighter. So he's just a great figure for someone who doesn't know much about this period to sort of pick out. But
he was really a shapeshifter in so many wonderful ways. I mean, he would go to court in these suits and, you know, the sort of high that's, I know Jason Carlin has talked about how the high collar in some circles was seen as effeminate. But he kind of had a gang of thugs that he sort of traveled with, a kind of posse, from what I understand. He was really a polarizing figure. I mean, but at the same time, he could be so many different things. You know, he could be this cultured British barrister. He lived in this center, if you think and talk about civil society, I mean, this center of theater associations, of lawyers' offices and doctors' offices when he was in London. And so he was really this kind of cosmopolitan figure. I mean, if you look at his library and the books that he requested that his wife bring to him while he was in prison, I mean, just an extraordinary list of readings in multiple languages. So he really wanted to be this kind of sort of almost nationalistic tough guy, but at the same time, very cosmopolitan and cultured. So really interesting character. Yes. Yeah.
Great. So you've already mentioned the fact that and the chapter lays out in great detail the fact that associations of legal advocates like him sort of including those that he was part of, paved the way for the first political parties in Japan, right? And you talked a little bit about the Liberal Party being a good example of this. Now, you previously mentioned an incident, the Fukushima incident, a little bit earlier in our conversation, and that also comes into play here as an important part of the story. Could you say a little bit more for listeners who've never heard of that incident about not only what the incident is, but how does this help us understand why or how it was that there was such a close relationship between legal advocates and political parties? What was that formative influence in developing, for example, the Liberal Party that may not have been there had the legal advocates not been such an important part of the story?
Yeah. I mean, we'd have to go back earlier. I think it well predates the Fukushima incident. I mean, the associations themselves, I mean, they were reading political theory from around the world. They were thinking about Japan in the context of you know, different sort of ideas about the rule of law and ideas about the individual and debates about freedom and all these kinds of things. And I do talk also a little bit about the sort of overlapping associations, like the Meirokusha, the Meiji Six Society, the Omeisha, the Debate Society. The Omeisha really had intense and tight ties to associations of legal advocates. So oftentimes these groups were places where people made a living while they engaged in political activism. And so I want to stress that the ideas, sort of private practice of law, both provided a material basis for their political activism, but it was also the context in which they really worked out and thought about in a practical way, like in a day-to-day occupational way, what many of these ideas meant within Japan's societal and political context. So so that process really began during the 1870s, from the mid-1870s for samurai. And we can see another figure that we haven't really mentioned is this guy, Shimamoto Nakamichi. Hoshitoru might be more well-known to folks, but Shimamoto Nakamichi, another figure who was one of the upper-level bureaucrats, but not top-level bureaucrats during the Meiji period, who left at the time over the debate of invading Korea. And then he was one of the figures sort of in the background of establishing the Hokushusha, and he became one of the head of their Tokyo branches. But he, sort of went back into the past and focused on the example of Oshiohei Hachiro, this former samurai who challenged the states. When we talked about the oppositional posture for private legal practitioners, I mean, Shimamoto Nakamichi is one of the figures who really tried to give some sort of historical heft to these former samurai who were private legal practitioners who were seeking to institute a new kind of political order grounded in ideas of freedom, grounded in ideas of a public sphere independent of state intervention, that were doing private legal work as their day jobs. So we see all that really from the middle of the 1870s. And by the time you get to 1883, you have the state, and we haven't really talked a whole lot about the state here, which is fine by me, but we can't leave it out of the picture entirely. The major states really getting nervous about this. We've seen the suppression of the Satsuma Rebellion successfully in 1877. But still, now we have these political parties and they're challenging the government. And so the Fukushima incident is really an attempt to suppress the Liberal Party within the Fukushima Prefecture by a very unpopular governor. And the Liberal Party really pushes the hand of the Meiji state. People are arrested. And then there's a trial that emerges out of this where the defendants are charged with treason because they've all they've supposedly signed an oath to overthrow the Meiji state. And the trial really hinges on the use of the term tempuku, or overthrow, and the lawyers in the case, including Hoshitoru and others, argue that this is not really, they didn't really try to overthrow the state, and they used French legal examples to say that there were no there's no concrete evidence that there had been a preparation to engage in a conspiracy. But ultimately their argument didn't prevail, but the sentences were pretty light in the Fukushima incident trial, relatively speaking.
Great. Yeah, by the 1870s, local associations of legal advocates are actually serving as the foundation for many of Japan's private universities. So they transform into law schools and then added other disciplines to them. So can you talk about that, sort of how the emergence of Japanese law schools from this context?
Yeah, interestingly, in 1880, there are these sort of major turning points in the regulation of legal practice within Japan from the state's perspective. So 1872, the establishment of all those new categories that you mentioned. 1876, there's a licensing test. And then in 1880, the state I argue that it was in some measure in response to the establishment of these hybrid associations funding the political activities of all these former samurai. But ultimately, the government says that you can no longer have these kinds of groups of these sort of hybrid law firms. Basically, they call them daigensha, associations of legal advocates. And so, what you begin to see over the course of the 1880s is that these associations of legal advocates sort of to try to figure out what course are they going to take. Are they going to flout the laws, which say they should disband? And some do. Are they going to focus, are they going to just simply focus on political activities, which some do, simply becoming political party branches? Or are they going to focus on their educational activities, which others do? And it's those associations that become first law schools and then go on to become some of the major private universities in Japan, including Senshu University, Meiji University, Hosei University, Waseda, and Chuo University. So this is a really untold part of the story, and that's why I didn't feel nervous about using the term legal epistemology that you mentioned earlier, because we really see law coming to the fore in so many ways, despite state efforts to suppress elements within society that are trying to make law mean something for people in society itself, and interpret law.
So. Now, I can't come to the conclusion of the interview without getting to that which I promised at the very beginning, and that is lawyers, the emergence of lawyers.
Right.
So in 1893, legal advocates become lawyers, and this happens through the passing of what's called the lawyer's law. So Ken, as a way to kind of wrap this up, before we get to our concluding questions, can you talk a little bit about that and the importance of that for the story that you're telling?
Sure. So, there's this ongoing problem for private legal practitioners within Japanese society, and that is the legacy of the Edo period, which is why I had to go back and think and talk about Edo. Because the Edo private legal practitioners were so close to the state and they occupied a kind of gray area, their successors, many of whom initially were those self-same private legal practitioners from the Edo period, and then other daigenin, really wanted to, in particular these former samurai political activist types, really wanted to sort of separate off the work that they did from that history. And so ultimately they decided that their goal would be to create a new status, new category, independent from the legal advocates, the dagenin, independent of the suit solicitors and suit ins, and to create something entirely new that would be, you know, globally recognizable. And so they settled on bengoshi, the contemporary Japanese term for lawyer. So this is where we see the private legal practitioners themselves organizing and pressing for a new category. And they're able to do this now. And we've been leaving out large elements of the story, but by the time they do this, we have, you know, Meiji Constitution, we have a national diet, and within that national diet, we have many private legal practitioners who are engaged in the work of creating this new category for themselves. So that's in a sense where the story wraps up with private legal practitioners having created some of the leading private universities within Japan, being key figures in the establishment of the major political parties within Japan, and also reformulating the basis for their own profession.
So, Daryl, now that we've come to our conclusion, as you just mentioned, we have left out large parts of the story, as it's of course necessary in any kind of attempt to spend 58 minutes or so talking about a very rich and very detailed, very exhaustively researched book. Are there any specific parts of that story and or any other elements of the craft of the book, the general context of the book, or anything else related to the book that you'd like to mention for listeners?
In the course of writing the book, it really came to me that, in terms of both interrogating the categories that I was examining, but also thinking about, sort of going back to, ideas of freedom or ideas of the public sphere or different, these kinds of things, it really came to me that we really still do inhabit, in a sense, a 19th century world. And that's striking to me in many ways. And so I really felt like I wanted to begin to explore that. And why I say that is that so many of the sort of the categories, the assumptions, the values the people hold dear in the contemporary world were institutionalized, formulated, came to life in this period. And what I'm really arguing in the book is that that was a global process, not a process that was brought to Japan, but a process that was worked out in a global way. So I hope that people take the book as a kind of departure point for thinking about the 19th century more broadly across this sort of recategorization or reevaluation of categories. So.
Well, so speaking of departure points, now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, what's next?
Thank you.
Are you currently inspired by any particular project or projects?
Yeah, I was really lucky when I was doing research for the book, and that I had an affiliation with Hosei University. So, one of the universities that sort of emerged out of this history itself. And I was able to, I looked at so many wonderful materials there. And one of the questions that I'm thinking and looking at for continuing the project into the early 19th, into the early 20th century, is the question of the jury system in Japan. And so right now I'm working on, I've sort of done a kind of book chapter on the first jury trial in Tokyo, which was a trial of a young woman who was charged with trying to burn down her sweet shop. And so I'm expanding that project and looking at Japanese society through the lens of that trial and reaction to that trial.
Excellent. Well, best of luck with that. Thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.